Mark Dernberger on the road again, and this time we're in Coon Rapids, Minnesota. Coon Rapids, we'll tell you about a little bit later. You may be familiar with it from the Doonesbury comic strip. But for more than 60 years, Coon Rapids has also been the home of a 50,000-watt clear channel radio station, WCCO. And for 32 of those 60 years, Jerry Miller was a very important part of the staff and finished his career at WCCO as chief engineer. So we couldn't think of a better guy to take us on a tour of the WCCO transmitter plant in Coon Rapids. And right now, Jerry, we're in the transmitter engineer's office.
This is a office that was occupied by many of the chiefs out here, the transmitter chief, really.
That was a pretty big title, wasn't it?
It was. It was a great title. It was a very important position to keep this station going.
Somebody told me that some of the early transmitter chiefs wore suit and tie.
Absolutely. One of the most memorable transmitter supervisors was George Collier. Of course, George Collier goes back to World War II, and he spent some time in England and on the research and development of radar over the horizon there to watch to make sure that when the Germans were coming across the channel, they could detect them. So it was that level of expertise and engineering that attracted George here after the war to be the engineering supervisor here at the transmitter. And he had so many stories to tell, and it was just a colorful period in my life to be able to have him under his tutelage here at the transmitter. Fantastic. And, of course, he was used to being in a uniform in the military. When he came out here at the transmitter, he was dressed up, and he represented the fact that this was just not a gardener's paradise out here, although it is 25 acres, a pretty rural facade. He came out in his finery just as he was going to dinner.
Typically, what did the chief transmitter engineer have to do? What was he responsible for?
Well, of course, keeping on the air, number one priority, but there was a whole string of duties, daily, weekly, monthly, and yearly, and he actually administrated the transmitter crew. It was not just the chief transmitter engineer. It was the support staff that he had out here. At one time, there were lockers. I think there were seven different lockers because it was manned 24 hours a day. There was always a person out here, and the chief engineer of the transmitter supervised all of those duties, which included daily routines, and you would come into the transmitter site and look at the file card and see that this was Wednesday, and on every Wednesday you would burnish the contracts on this type of audio rack, and on Thursday you do this, and then of course you had your seasonal routines. Sometimes we're involved in taking some field strength readings out to see how the signal was doing, and of course the maintenance of the facility.
Now, and then back to FCC compliance. What did they have to do to comply with FCC operation?
Well, of course, you had to log everything. You had to log your meter readings. We had to do that in the early days. We'd do it every 15 minutes, then it was every half an hour, and then it was every 3 hours, and now you have to log it as often as necessary to feel that you're in compliance. So the rules have really, really changed, but certainly taking frequency measurements. Of course, taking the readings, all of your plate voltage, plate current readings, the tower base antenna current, of course, told you how many RF amps you had going into a 50-ohm load, or in this case it was a 79-ohm load, and the RF current was 24.6 amps, and if you do your math on that, that comes out to about 50,000 watts of power delivered into that antenna.
So you were logging it. So I could go back to a log that was written out here in 1940 and find out how much power you were putting out on May 5th, 1940.
Oh, sure, and that was part of the record keeping that you needed. But What we really were doing there is assuring the management and the ownership that the station was running on all eight cylinders, 830, and, of course, at the same time complying with the FCC. And, of course, you had to maintain your frequency plus or minus 20 cycles for AM in modern times. Hardly ever had to touch that. But in the early days, it was critical, of course.
Well, let's take a tour, Jerry, of this transmitter plant. This building was built in...
Well, the groundbreaking here happened in 1937. It went on the air in 1938.
The building is, in today's radio business, it's kind of disappointing. You go out to these transmitter sites, and there's no one around. We know that transmitter that I'm looking at over there, that Harris DX50, is being controlled from a studio downtown. And there's no need to have someone out here.
Well, it's different, and of course the whole world is different. This is not the era of my youth, but the building is in great shape. It's a concrete building. It's got hot water heat in it, you know. So, but it has changed, and it doesn't have maybe the energies and the synergies of engineers running here and there and things to do. It's been a victim of evolutionary technology and reliability. Reliability has allowed this station to be unmanned because of remote control and new transmitters. The transmitters that we have here today, of course, are nowhere near the care and feeding that we had to implement with the old transmitters.
We're standing in a room that's, I'm guessing 40 by 30 and about 18 feet tall here, would you say?
Yes, it's a very high ceiling. And
what's the reason for that? I noticed that the transmitters are enclosed.
Well, the reason for it is there's plenums above the transmitter, and having tall ceilings allowed for plenty of air to be there. And, of course, in the older days, we had taller equipment.
All right, we're standing in front of the transmitter control console.
Well, this desk goes back to my very first days here at WCCO, where this control console gave you command and control over the two transmitters that were here. At the time that I first walked into the building, there were two Western Electric water-cooled transmitters. They still, to this day, have two transmitters, a main and an auxiliary. But as we stand here today, the framework of the old console, the desk, the drawers on each side, the meters are here. To my left, we're looking at a Continental 317C that replaced the old Western Electric water-cooled transmitter. And then looking straight on over the desk, we now see a brand-new solid-state Harris 50-kilowatt transmitter.
But from this desk, this is sort of the nerve center.
When you were on duty, you were here. Right over in this drawer right here, we had a file card. Oh, my God, they're still there. Here are the routine file cards that you would do on Monday morning. See this? It says Monday morning. What would you do there? What's it say there?
First, inspect all equipment upstairs and down for proper operation. When in use, check humidifier, oil, motor, fill with water as necessary. Take transmitter meter readings, throw line key. On odd dates, you'd throw it to line number one.
That's right.
And then on even dates, you'd throw it to line number two.
Okay, that.
And what is line number one and line number two?
Well, transmitter line number one and number two. The audio phone lines from downtown.
There were two separate phone lines.
Yes, so if one failed. But that was your daily routine, and it just... And that goes back to 1963. I guess I was there at that time. I was here in 1963. So at that time, I was doing some of these routine. God, wasn't that something to open that drawer and see these routine cards still here today? It gives me a chill. And then we had the evening shift. They had to do their duties. Here was on an evening shift.
Dust off front of both transmitters and outside of attached fences. Clean all front panel glass.
Absolutely.
Yep. Dust off front of audio equipment.
And you have to remember, George Collier was sitting in a suit right in that office over there looking through those glass windows. And you better well, if there was a nut or a bolt missing, he would know about it.
Now, in the shop, every 3 months, you had to sort all nut and bolt jars so that each had its proper size.
Well, that's correct,
this place was like a military office.
Yes, and the janitor even had his routine of cleaning and sweeping the floors. I'm very pleased to report to all the listeners out there that this floor that we're standing on right now is
glossy.
It's glossy, and it's stayed really shiny, and it's a nice build. Actually, this building would remind you of a firehouse, really. It was spick and span. It was like you would go into a fire department. So anyhow, I'll put these cards back in our drawer over here to the right.
Now, here is a clock that runs backwards. Can you explain what that was for?
Well, that's for your downtime. One clock would stop exactly when the outage occurred, and the other clock would start telling you how long you were off the air. And then right above there, we have, of course, the most critical parameter of all, and that's the RF current into the antenna.
All right, I'm looking at some transmission lines, which are the cables that carry the signal out there, but they're at 50,000 watts, and they're not just ordinary cables, are they?
Well, no, these are actually copper tubes with an insulated center conductor.
These things are 3.5 inches in diameter, aren't they?
Yes.
And how big is the conductor in the middle, inside?
It's about an inch or so.
Are they kept under pressure to keep water out?
Yes, there's pressure to keep the integrity of the line so that no moisture gets in there. And then, of course, they run underground all the way out to the tower. They run out to the tower some 600 and plus feet underground.
You have two of those, too?
There are two of them. One for
If one fails?
Oh, yeah. One fails, you got a backup on it. And then they come up into the transmitter tuning unit, the ATU, which is housed in a big building out there. And from there, it goes into a matching network, which retunes it to the tower.
And then overhead here is the plumbing that switches all of these.
Well, this is an automatic transfer switch. It's a remote control motorized patch cord, really. It can either look at the transmitter 1, transmitter 2, or the dummy load. During normal operation, it routes the RF energy from the transmitter that's selected to be on the air out to the antenna tuning unit.
Well, it's midwinter here in Minnesota, so we're not going out to the tower site. I hope you don't mind, but maybe you could do a quick description of that tower, and we'll talk about why it's too long.
Well, it was originally designed for 810 kilohertz, and when they moved to 830...
That would have been in 1941.
Yes, a shorter tower could have been used, but the fact of the matter, they had the steel in place, and why do that when you can do it electrically with a antenna tuning unit?
What's the size of that tower? What are the? How big do you think the face is?
The face of the tower is about 5 feet.
5 feet, and it's 652
feet high, and its guide has two layers of guying on it.
But not at the top, I noticed.
Not at the top. The top section stands alone.
So there's guys at about a couple hundred feet?
Yes.
And maybe about 500 feet?
Right. And they are about the size of your thumb, the wire itself. And they're connected to insulating balls to make sure that the tower itself is the antenna, unlike FM, where the tower is a tower and the antenna then is mounted to the tower. Here, in AM broadcasting, the tower is the antenna along with the ground system. What you see here at the antenna aspect is only half of the antenna. The other half, of course, is in the ground. There's radials at every 3 degrees, and they go out in a circle around the base of the antenna for 365 degrees. And, of course, one of the routines on your little checklist, your daily checklist or monthly checklist, I guess, it was to check the radials. Just buzz them out and make sure that way back in the early days, a cow hadn't stepped through there and busted one of those radials or a gopher got it.
You're talking about all these copper, it's like a fan of copper wires in the ground.
Yes.
And they go out at least as far as the tower is long. First of all, how tall is this tower?
652 feet.
Okay, so let's say that these copper wires go out 650 feet and they just stop. How can you, what'd you call it, buzzing them out?
Well, buzzing them out. In this case here at WCCO, there's a stake out there at the end of each radial. And what we did is have a buzzer from one radial to the next. Of course, when you actually buzzed out or rung out the radials, you would attach one end of your ohmmeter to one of the stakes. And the other, you'd have a line over to the other one.
You wanted to make sure that the copper was continuous from all the way into the tower and back out on the other one. That's how you got your circuit.
Okay. Exactly.
All right. We're talking with former chief engineer Jerry Miller.
WCCO, as we know it, was put on the air as WLAG in 1922. 1924, after it had been off the air for a short period of time, turned to WCCO on 810.
How much power do you think?
500 watts of power, and then it went to 5,000 watts. And then in 1937, 38, it turned to a 50,000-watt, the clear channel station. But it was exciting times, if you can imagine. 1922, 24, everything was busting out all over in America. I mean, they call it the Roaring Twenties, where Model A's and steam engines and telegraph lines and railroads were crossing the country. And this fine signal here was skipping across America to Finland and Norway and Europe. And so the genie was out of the bottle for that time. This was exciting time. People were crossing oceans, coming to America, and CCO was a part of that along with WLAG, and KDKA was part of that. And so it was very, very exciting times. And here was WCCO up in the Midwest, and they were launching this magnificent conveyance for the public.
But they weren't operating with a vertical tower, if I remember correctly.
No, as a matter of fact, there were two towers out here and a long wire strung between the two towers.
A horizontal flat top? Is that what?
A horizontal flat top. And as a matter of fact, there is a plan ready to go, I would hope, to string up a horizontal wire. It would be directional, of course, to some extent, but the way it's laid out, it would cover the Minneapolis-St. Paul area pretty effectively. So, yes, going back to those early days when the Lone Ranger rode the prairie and WCCO was flying, it was a long wire antenna between two towers.
Now, when did the big tower go up, the one that's out there now?
The big tower went up in 37, 38, and it's still there today. It's 652 feet high.
Jerry, here's a map put out by the U.S. Government Printing Office with some circles on it that purport to be the signal coverage that WCCO would have had with 750,000 watts. And there was some talk at one time of selecting a group of clear channel stations and giving them that kind of power, more than 10 times the currently authorized 50,000. Look at those signals. Daytime signal down into the middle of Arkansas and Oklahoma and Colorado and Wyoming. Oh, my word.
That proposal was during the time that you worked here at WCCO, as you recall.
Yes.
And this was to cover the white areas in the United States, and a few of the stations proposed to have that happen. And, of course, then it turned to where clear channel does not have the meaning it did in the early days where it was really clear. WCCO currently is only protected out to the about the 750-mile contour in terms of the redefined clear channel reach.
What do you say by protected? There can't be a station inside that?
Yeah, it depends on what the frequency is in the ground, but it's basically out to about the 750 miles. It says 760 on here.
All right. Let's continue our tour, Jerry. Where are we going now?
Well, we're going down to where we had the water storage area.
Water storage.
And that was for the original transmitters, the Western Electric transmitters. And we had water down here. We also had some...
What did you use the water for?
For water-cooled transmitter tubes. I ran through the tubes. And these big concrete blocks were for generators, grid generators and bias generators, along with some other ones on another in the other room down here.
Basically, what we had down here was a couple of big motors spinning.
Yes.
Spooky place, I bet, when it was running. Huh?
Yeah.
Here's an old loudspeaker. Let's see what happens. No, I don't hear any ghosts coming out of there. Okay, you just turned on another.
I don't know how the pipes went. I think they went through that wall, but there was also a water supply in this room, I remember.
And you said water, purified water.
Purified distilled water for the transmitters. And the transmitter tubes were not quite 6 feet tall. Of course, they were water-cooled to keep them cool.
How did you take the heat out of the water?
There was a heat exchanger, like a radiator, piped it through the radio and discharged it into the building for heat in the building. It's cold here today. I've still got my jacket on.
Yep.
This is the baffles for the air intake from comes from the cupola. On the top of the roof, there's a cupola, and that air falls all the way down. We're in the basement now, all the way down this shaft, into this there, and then it's fed back into the transmitter for cooling.
All right, judging by the look of this next structure here, this must be the fallout shelter. And I bet it is, because it's got that L-shaped entrance. Why did they do this? Why do you come in and then have to go to the right and then go to the left?
Well, radiation travels in a straight line, and that would prevent that.
Oh, so it couldn't make the turn.
Couldn't make the turn, theoretically.
All right, so now we're in the fallout shelter. And like the fallout shelters in the other stations we've visited, this one seems to become a storeroom for stuff. Old turntables, tape recorders, amplifiers, and cots.
And then in this little room adjacent to the fallout shelter is where we kept a store of food and water. I wonder if it's in there. Some of the stores. Here's survival biscuits in there and other different things. Water we had in this private room here, which is a combination of that and storage, but we had the foodstuffs in here.
How much food did you keep here?
A month's supply at one time. I see it's...
For two people?
Yeah,
probably.
For two people.
And it's still here?
Well, I wouldn't want to eat those biscuits. And then we had a...
Three bunks.
Three bunks so that you could have your own bunk and the own air exchanger. Now, this is a filtered air. It's a tube that runs up an outside, and it's a charcoal filter at that end. And it catches all the alpha and beta particles that might be in the air from radiation. So when those particles are filtered out, so you have
So this is your filtered fresh air supply.
Filtered fresh air.
Okay. And then, as is usual in the fallout shelter, we see enough equipment here to run the station from right here.
Well, that's right. And of course, the first thing to run it is you got to have command and control. And in this panel right here is the control of transmitter 1 and transmitter 2.
This is a clone of the desk that you showed us upstairs. Yeah. So you can turn them on and off from here. You can switch either transmitter to the antenna.
And so you have control of the transmitter from here in a manual sort of way. There's a audio console.
So this is a mini radio station.
A little mini radio station. You have a tape that we put up here. I think this is the same tape that I put up in 94. And when you hear that tape on the air, you know that there's something wrong, that you've lost your link. This station is linked both by a landline and an STL, studio to transmitter link, to
microwave down to downtown
Minneapolis. And if both of those should be severed for some reason or another.
If, God help it, there were a fire at the studio.
Exactly. This will give you, at that speed, I suppose, an hour?
Hour and a half.
Hour and a half to get out here and take control.
So this is canned programming.
Canned programming.
This, yeah.
And I got to tell you a side story. Very early on in my days here at WCCO, we had a bad storm, and Bob Wallner said, you better go out to the transmitter. I'd only been out. I was out here as a kind of a journeyman under George Collier. I didn't really know the ropes too much, but he dispatched me out here. And lo and behold, we lost both feeds, the landline and the STL at the time. So we had a transmitter with no input audio. Aha! My chance to be on the air. And I was down here at the studio. We had a 16-inch turntable here. Right. And so I played records and made the station break on the hour.
What a thrill. On 50,000 watts.
And at that time, I was running up and down the stairs trying to figure out what was wrong, how to coordinate with the telephone company to get the service back, playing the records down here and making the station break. So that's about, as you can well imagine, that's the only time they ever used this old guy's voice on the air.
Did you do a legal ID?
I did a legal ID, which consisted of WCCO followed by the city of license.
What a thrill.
And then I ended up staying here for a few days after that. I wonder what my wife thought.
All right, coming out of there, now back into another big room, and there's humongous power control panels on the wall over here to my right. That obviously is for the
company. 440 coming into the building from two directions, two different power sources from two different sources of power come into the site and then are distributed to the transmitters. And we have
so theoretically, if a windstorm hits and a big branch hits a power line, and if it does take one, the side that's being fed that's on the air,
right?
How do you switch back to the other side?
Well, it's got a transfer panel. It's a parallel feed.
Automatically?
Yeah. Good. And, of course, then if that fails, we have a big diesel transfer panel back there that'll transfer from the land power to the diesel power.
Now, what is this humongous thing that looks like a big old motor?
Well, this is for the Western Electric bias generators.
This is like a generator set?
Yeah.
Like a dynamo. This shaft turned and generated a voltage.
Exactly.
Well, here's the output. Here's the wire. Look at the size of those wires.
And that stands on a concrete curb, which is knee-high, 6 feet across and 12 feet long. And there were two of these at one time. There's only one here left. I don't know where the other one went, but it's gone.
This thing's humongous.
It runs at 1,750 RPMs. It delivers 550 amps, and the voltage is 24 volts.
So this might have been the power supply for the filaments for the tubes. Now, here's another room full of stuff. Oh, my goodness.
This room is directly below the transmitters, and you can see there's a big hole in the ceiling up there, and this is where the water cooling was piped in here. And this was kind of a Frankenstein's monster room, if you can imagine the pipes and the water and the plumbing and running up to the transmitter. So that transmitter was supported by air going out the top of 18-foot ceiling, and then we're in the basement right now with another 18, 20-foot ceiling, which housed the water transfer.
This place is pretty well maintained, painted well, and the steps are in good shape. And now we are in the boiler room.
Yes. One nice thing about the WCCO transmitter building is the fact that it's built like a bunker. Please understand that there's poured concrete walls that are 12 inches thick. A boiler system that gives you hot water throughout the whole building. A boiler with a self-contained 15 or 20,000 gallon tank that will give it
diesel.
Well,
it's fuel oil.
It's fuel oil that provides for the not only the generator but for the heat in the building, the hot water. And when you look at this, it looks like you're in a ship.
Yeah, it does. Doesn't
it?
The
does.
Engine room.
Yeah,
the
engine room of the ship, where you can see we've got 5 pounds of pressure on there right now. Or...
Okay, we're going up another set of steps to the machine shop. And here we see a lathe, a serious lathe, a drill press, a grinder. Why would you need all these tools here?
Well, because we tool our own parts. You would make your sockets if you had to, or you could turn out any part that you might need, because you had to be more or less self-sufficient in those days. This was kind of the command tower. During the war, there were lights put on this whole facility. Each guy wire had a light shining on it on the side of the building. There's lights that face out to the antenna tuning unit, which is a building about 600-700 feet from here to the north of where we're standing. We're standing in a kind of a, if you can envision, a bridge with windows. It's kind of like a bridge of a ship where you can look north, south, east, every but west, and kind of survey the situation. So you'd have lights at night to see the towers. And
so they took the potential of sabotage very seriously.
Absolutely. And especially with this big voice of WCCO, it was, of course, one of the very strong players in the Conelrad system and then EAS and getting out the word.
I sense you have some thoughts you want to share with us.
In 1960-some, I got on with Kermit Sucker at WCCO Radio and stayed there for 32 years. But gosh, what a delight. What a journey. And the only thing that I can think about is we step in now to the new millennium, that so much of that is kind of repeating itself, at least in my mind, with the Internet and with all the different modes of conveying and communicating that is coming online. I'm as excited now as I was then, because it's not about the delivery system. Of course, AM was magical and romantic, and the fade in and the fade out and coast to coast and listening, oh, that was magical. But in my mind today, surfing the net and what's happening in the world, it's unbelievable. So it's been a lifelong journey, and being able to share that with you here and walk this walk that maybe only you and I really appreciate.
Oh, I think you'll be pleasantly surprised to find that most of our listeners are right here with you, Jerry.
Okay. Well, it's been wonderful. I think CCO is sure it's about generators and transmitters and brick and mortar and electrons and 25 amps into a set, but it's not about the delivery system. It's about what is being said, what is being felt, what good you can do. You know, you learn your trade, you earn enough, and then you got to return something back to the industry. And I got to tell you, Mark, that if any broadcaster that I've known has returned some of the heritage, it's been you in your articles of Clear Channel. Hey, this is just the beginning. By the time we get another 20 years down the road, it's going to be unbelievable. 10 times what we've already seen.